All right, how are you doing tonight? Okay, good to see you. It's been a while. When my wife and I were married 37 years ago, her uncle got to the church late. It was a June wedding, evening wedding, candlelight wedding, this big cathedral my wife had been raised in. And as her uncle arrived 15 minutes late, he ascended the stairs of this cathedral, looks down the flagstone aisle to the altar under the stained glass window where we were exchanging vows at that very moment. It had been a drizzly, rainy Friday. Saturday. Oh, yes. I remember it well. And I looked. I know, because the Department of Revenue always sends our license renewals to Richard and Christ Hammer. Her name's Christine. She's the most Christ-like person I've ever met. And for the state of Missouri to recognize that every month, I mean, that's awesome. But anyway, he ascended the stairs. He looks down the flagstone aisle. There we were at the altar, under the stained glass window, exchanging vows. And at that moment, the rain stopped, the clouds parted, and a brilliant shaft of sunlight bathed the entire front of that church. And just as he was about to enter through the doorway, he happened to look up, and there, arcing over the church, was a magnificent rainbow. Unbelievable. We've taken that as a sign of divine favor. And you might ask, what is this thing telling us this story for? Well, that was kind of an NEO, wasn't it? So there we go. That's pretty far. But the reason I brought it up was this. Somebody mentioned double rainbow. And on our 20th anniversary, 17 years ago, here we are at the 21st floor of the Hammond's Towers, the Tower Club, having dinner. And we were seated by the windows, and it had been a drizzly day, just like the day we were married. And my wife said at about 8:15, this is the very moment that we were exchanging vows 20 years ago. And we just spontaneously looked out the window, the clouds parted, the sun came out, and overarching the entire building was a double rainbow on our 20th anniversary. Unbelievable. So, there's my NEO story, and two of them. But I've got an awesome NEO story to tell you tonight. Don't leave early. We should be out of here by 10. Okay? So I'm going to talk about NEOs tonight, all right? Near-Earth objects. Let's take a look at it. It's important to have some understanding of planetary formation to understand the concept of NEOs. And this is not, what I'm going to talk about is not accepted by all astronomers. There are many theories of planetary formation, but this is probably the leading theory. And that's the idea that the sun, of course, came from a big cloud of hydrogen gas that began to compress. It eventually, there was enough pressure to cause the heat to be high enough to trigger proton-proton fusion reactions to cause the star to illuminate. But around that debris of that cloud, especially if it was in the vicinity of a previous supernova that seeded the vicinity with metallic elements, basically anything above an atomic number of 2, you had rocky debris, you have dust, all orbiting in the same trajectory as that star, in our case, in a counterclockwise motion. All of it, with some exceptions due to impacts. For example, Jupiter's 63-plus moons now, many of them, in fact, a majority, are orbiting in a retrograde motion. They're not orbiting in the same direction that Jupiter is spinning. Why is that? Either they've been captured in more recent history or a collision. Okay. Why is Uranus orbiting like a propeller at about a 90-degree incline around the sun? Impact at some point in the past. So anyway, what happened was these chunks, they would slam into each other. This was a dynamic environment. And as they did, they created tremendous heat. They became malleable. And some of them began to fuse together. And the larger ones had greater gravitational attraction. They were more massive. They started to attract more and more debris. And so you had clumps that got bigger and bigger and formed planetesimals, protoplanets. And eventually they got bigger and bigger. But a lot of this debris remained. Now, over time, the sun's solar wind cleared and cleansed the inner solar system from much of this debris, but it remains in the outer solar system, as we'll see. It's a dynamic place out there. Many of the asteroids, the vast majority of the asteroids, of course, do not have enough mass to achieve what is called hydrostatic equilibrium, where they achieve a spherical shape. Only the biggest ones do, like Ceres. We'll see, I'll show you a picture of that here in a minute. This is very reminiscent of many of the moons of Saturn and Jupiter. They're not large enough to form a spherical shape. There's not enough mass. And by the way, you remember the IAU definition of a planet now. One of the three components is it's massive enough to form a spherical shape through hydrostatic equilibrium. Okay? Here's a depiction of the asteroid belt between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. So you see that? Look at the debris. These are known asteroids that have been charted around the asteroid belt, which is between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And if you look at the vast gulf here between Mars and Jupiter, you know, Jupiter's out to almost 500 million miles. Many people thought, years gone by, that, well, the asteroid field must be, or belt, must be the debris of a former planet that disintegrated somehow. But we now know that's not true because the estimated mass of the entire asteroid belt is about 2% the lunar mass. So this was no disintegrated planet. This is the remnants of the protoplanetary disk that created our solar system. Now you'll see here there are certain asteroids that are in Jupiter's orbit that are called Trojans and the Greeks. I thought Trojans were Greeks. No, well, I guess you could debate that. But these are at the L4 and L5 Lagrange points in the orbit of Jupiter. These are kind of gravitationally null points where as long as they stay in that position, 60 degrees in back of and 60 degrees in front of Jupiter, they maintain that orbit without ever impacting Jupiter. Okay, those are the Trojans and the Greeks. The Hildas are another category defined by a more elliptical orbit, and I'm not going to go into any more detail on that. But you'll notice that the inner solar system is largely clear of this debris compared to the orbit between Mars and Jupiter. In fact, NASA was concerned when we sent up the first interplanetary probes, the Pioneer 10 and 11, that they would not make it through the asteroid belt. And it was for that reason we sent them up in pairs, 10 and 11. They made it. Well, still, when the Voyager spacecraft went up a few years later, Voyager 1, Voyager 2, we sent them up in a pair in case one was destroyed by an impact. All four made it. Here's an actual rendition of known asteroids. My Sky Pro software, the latest edition, tracks about 500,000 asteroids. And I'll come back to that very important statement later this evening when I share with you an amazing discovery that I had in my driveway just a few months ago. And so here we see the Earth. Let's focus on the Earth's orbit, this white circle. This little yellow dot's not drawn to scale. That's the sun. Here's the point. Every one of these dots represents a known asteroid. For every known asteroid, there are hundreds, maybe thousands of unknown asteroids. But you look at the green ones, and those are asteroids with very little risk of crossing the Earth's orbit. In fact, they don't cross it right now. That's not to say they won't cross it, because over given enough time, think of the gravitational dynamics of what you're looking at here on the screen. I mean, it's possible some of them could be tugged in for a variety of reasons into the slightly closer to the inner solar system and actually reach an Earth-intersecting orbit. So you can't say it's impossible, but it's very little risk. Now, if we go up the risk scale to the yellow asteroids, these are called the Amors asteroids. These are asteroids that presently do not intersect the Earth's orbit, but boy, they come close. Look at all these things. Those have a more of a moderate degree of risk, okay? But the ones that we're most concerned about are the red. Every red dot you see there, these are called the Apollo asteroids. They have an orbit. Was that a cell phone going off? You know what happens when I hear a cell phone go off? I stop and I leave. I get so indignant. Okay. Well, come to think. But what happened was, my wife and I have been to the opera in Chicago 44 times. I know you're thinking, oh my goodness, you got to be kidding me. That's like my definition of hell. Well, we tried it. And I was thinking, I'm not sure this is going to go. My wife loves music. So we went there. So the first opera we went to was Wagner's only comedic opera, Der Meistersinger. 6 hours in German with two intermissions. And I said, there he is again. So I said, if you want to leave by the first intermission, that'll be fine with me. So, but we didn't. And we stayed for the whole thing. And at midnight, it ended. It started at 6 p.m. And we could have sat and watched it again. And we went back 43 or 44 more times. It was awesome. But they have a 3,500 seats. It's sold out for decades. It's just an unbelievable thing. Five balconies, opulent architecture. It's just incredible. They make a big deal about cell phones going off. They warn you before the guy comes out on the stage. Absolutely no cell phones. Your program they give you. If a cell phone goes off, some of these prima donnas walk off the stage, literally, and the curtain comes down and that's it. So you don't want to be the person that's responsible for that. So when I heard that, I thought, I'm going to try that. So, I speak several times a year around at conferences all over the country, the world to some extent. And I was speaking at a large conference in the Los Angeles area. There were, 500 or 600 people there. And it was like half. I was speaking for about 3 hours. Right in the middle of my presentation, just before the intermission, a cell phone went off, just like John's. I put the mic down and I started walking off the stage. And then I kind of stopped myself and I thought, well, I didn't warn them. So I'm going to come back. So I came back and I said, listen, I didn't warn you. There were people wondering, what's that guy doing? I said, I leave the stage if the cell phone goes off. So now you're warned. So anyway, 10 minutes went by. We had the intermission and I was talking to some people and this guy was waiting to speak to me. And finally, he made his way through the crowd, and he said, Mr. Hammer, I'm so sorry. That was my cell phone that went off tonight. You see, I'm on the waiting list for a heart transplant, and I've got to be on call 24/7. That could be my call. Oh, man, I felt so bad about it. And ever since then, I said, hey, cell phones go off. That may be the guy's call, right? So no reason he could. That's right. He's on the list. Yeah. But anyway, so getting back to our slide here. So the red means these are known asteroids with an Earth intersecting orbit. Now, the point is, when they intersect the orbit, are we going to be there at that moment? That's the key. So they intersect the orbit once or twice on their trajectory around the sun. Are we going to be at that spot? Well, the answer is probably not in most cases. But given enough of these red dots and enough time, you see what I mean? It's inevitable. The only question then is, how big is it? There's 300 known red dots. NASA estimates there are 100,000 to 1 million unknown red dots. Isn't that amazing? In other words, we may not even know it. That's happened a couple of times in the last few years, where an NEO passed close by within the moon's orbit. And we didn't even know it. In one case, until 2 or 3 days before. Another case, I'm thinking of, until 2 or 3 days after it passed. I told my neighbor. He said, what are you doing out here at night? I said, I'm looking for near-Earth objects that are potentially could destroy civilization. So he's, just keep doing what you're doing. It's a tireless job. No questions. Okay. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I'm just going to say, what you're talking about, this is one of the concerns with NASA, is when the astronauts are outside the spacecraft,
yeah,
they are very concerned about that, about what you're talking
about. Yeah, not just this, but bolts, pieces of debris from booster rockets, and you name it. There's millions of bits out there.
It could be a very small piece.
It could be. That would be the equivalent of a high-speed rifle bullet. Yeah. It's a shooting gallery out there. Okay. Don't have to be. Don't have to be.
True. I mean, they can be thrown one way or the other.
Yeah. The plane doesn't matter. It's whether their orbit, if you sketch their orbit out, whether that intersects the Earth's orbit at a point. Some of these have highly inclined orbits. You know, I would say, I don't know, some of them might be 20, 30 degrees, but many of them would be near the solar plane, the Earth-Sun plane. Yeah. Four score and 7 years ago. Yeah, we're talking about NEOs, near Earth objects. Okay. Who are you?
Andrew.
Okay. Glad to have you with us. Do you like astronomy? Or do you like beekeeping? You know, because some people stumble in here because the beekeepers are next door. So the question is, and many of them have orbits that are, well, of course, Kepler taught us in his first law of planetary motion that orbiting objects don't have circular orbits. Certainly the planets don't. They're ellipses. Some of these are highly eccentric. That plays into the risk as well. Now look at this. Here's the far side of the moon. You talk about a shooting gallery. What does this indicate? There have been tremendous impactors in the past. We have not seen an impact on the moon since Galileo invented the first telescope, not the first magnifying glass, but the first telescope in 1608. Nobody has seen a confirmed impact on the moon since then, with the sole exception of the kid in Colorado with the homemade telescope back in the 50s thought that he saw an impact, a small impact. That's never been confirmed. Well, anyway, it's been a dynamic environment. And keep in mind, this is the moon. It's 2% the mass of the Earth. So if the moon attracted this kind of interaction, think of the impacts that have happened on this planet. And we don't look like this. And why is that?
Weather.
Erosion. Erosive forces. Yeah. Incidentally, what's the main difference you see here between the far side and the near side of the moon, the side facing us and the side that doesn't? You know, the Earth and moon have a one-to-one or spin orbital resonance. So the same side of the moon is essentially facing us. We can actually see about 57, I think, percent of the surface of the moon due to libration and other forces. What is the immediate difference you see here versus the side of the moon that faces us? The what? Exactly. Only about, what, I think 5% of the surface of the far side has Maria, whereas it's about 30% of the near side, our side. Here's Callisto, one of Jupiter's four major moons. Some have said that it's probably the most cratered object in the solar system. But again, I just show you this to show you the number of craters, how common these craters are. The biggest feature here is this drainage, well, not drainage, but this basin here is called Valhalla. It's about 3,000 kilometers. The diameter of Callisto is about 5,000, a little less than 5,000 kilometers. And here's one of the messenger photos of the planet Mercury. And again, look at the density of the asteroid impacts. Let's look at some upcoming close approaches to Earth, various asteroids, and look at this. This column here is, to me, the interesting one. It's missed distance in LDs. That's lunar diameters. Not lunar diameters, but lunar distances. The average distance between the Earth and the Sun, we'll say, of the Earth and the Moon, we'll say 230,000 miles, roughly. Okay. Now, it varies between, what, 215 and 245 or so. But we'll average it out to 230. So look at this. Here's one that's coming by. What is today, the 24th? Two nights from now. There's one going by. We won't be able to see it because of the cloud cover. It's going to be 48, and what's the magnitude? 19. Yeah, we can see that, Dale. With the short CCD image, you could. There's no doubt. But 48 lunar distances, that's 48 times 230,000, 11 million miles, something like that. Compare that to the distance from the Earth to Mars or Venus, the two closest planets, right now, because they're both close to opposition, I think Venus is about 150, 140 million miles away. Mars is about 215 million miles away. So compare that to this, 11 million miles. Now let's go down here. And by the way, that's a 390-meter diameter. How about this one? 13 lunar distances. When is that going to be? May the 30th. That's only about 3 million miles. That's just an extraordinarily short distance. And you go down the list and look at this. On June 1st, this is a magnitude 17 because look at how big the thing is, between 1 and 2.3 kilometers. That would have massive impact if that, depending on its angle, its trajectory, if it impacted the Earth. And you can look down. Yeah, here's a 0.9 lunar distance. That's on June 2nd. But it's only 5.7 meters, and so look at it, it's a magnitude 28. 0.9. You see anything closer than that? No. But it's interesting to look at the, look at this, 2 to 4.5 kilometers on June 11. So you can see, the bigger the size, the smaller, the brighter the magnitude, 15.6. But the point is, look at all these things flying by. These are asteroids. These are some of those red dots that we were talking about. Okay? Now, let's take a look at the nearest approaches that we know of currently. And believe me, there'll be others that we don't, there are many others we don't know of. The close approaches to the Earth. I'll draw your attention to this one right here, Apophis, April 13th, 2029. It comes within 1/10 the lunar distance, 0.1 LD, 22,000. That's less than 3 Earth diameters, put it in those terms. That's a near miss. And these are all the known near misses right now. There's initial observations that are, the error bars are pretty wide. And then further, and I'll show you an example of that here in a minute, succeeding measurements refine it. I think the next slide, I'll show you a slide on that in just a minute. So NEOs, near-Earth objects, by one count is 5,400, 65 comets, 5,200 asteroids, 928 potentially hazardous asteroids, PHAs, that are 1 kilometer or larger. At this point, the highest known risk is an asteroid called 1950 DA, possible collision in the year 2880, which would be an extinction event if that happens, unless we do something about it. We'll talk about what that might be here in just a minute. There are over 300 known objects on Earth crossing orbits, the majority of which are potentially capable of causing death and destruction on a scale unheard of in human history. And here we are going about our business, and who thinks about this? Not a lot of people. What did Arnold Toynbee, the great historian, say? That civilization exists at the pleasure of geology. Even conservative estimates would suggest that for every asteroid on a dangerous Earth-crossing orbit, there are hundreds or more which have yet to be discovered. I don't want to depress you tonight. This is realistic. We got to be realistic. We've got to face fear. I shouldn't be showing you these images. Okay, close your eyes. So, is this our future? Could we survive an impact like this? We look up some clear day and see this. Here's the Torino scale, which gives the risk associated with particular NEOs, starting with zero, basically no risk. Their likelihood of a collision is zero, or is so low to be effectively zero. Also applies to small objects such as meteors and bodies that burn up in the atmosphere. You know, we have about, 8 to 9 billion meteorites that hit the atmosphere every day, and they incinerate, not the vast majority of them. And what happens? They turn to dust, and they waft down to the surface of the Earth. You go out to your car. You just washed it. You left it out overnight. You come in, it's full of dust, and you think, what in the world? How is this possible? And what do? You start wiping it off. That is your connection to the cosmos. That is micrometeorite dust. that is the result of some a vast number of meteorites hitting the atmosphere, incinerating, and their dust wafting down, ending their ageless journey on your car. Green is one. Routine discovery in which a pass near the Earth is predicted that poses no unusual level of danger. And that the highest that we've ever had is a 4. That was Apophis, based on the initial data. A close encounter meriting attention by astronomers. It's been reduced, I think, to a 2, by the way. Current calculations give a 1% or greater chance of collision capable of regional devastation. Most likely, new telescopic observations will lead to a reassignment to level 0. Attention by public officials is merited if it's less than a decade away. Then you get into the threatening, what is called the orange. 5, 6, 7, 8. Look at number 7, for example. A very close encounter by a large object, which, if occurring this century, poses an unprecedented but still uncertain threat of a global catastrophe. For such a threat in this century, international contingency planning is warranted, especially to determine urgently and conclusively whether or not a collision will occur. These are the threatening. This is the threatening zone. Then you get down to the red, which is the certain collision zone. And you look at number 8. A collision is certain, capable of causing localized destruction for an impact over land or possibly a tsunami if close offshore. Such events occur on average between once per 50 years and once per 1,000 years. And then 9. Collision is certain, capable of causing unprecedented regional devastation. Such events occur on average of once every 10,000 years. To once every 100,000. And then 10, the highest category of risk, a collision is certain, capable of causing global climatic catastrophe that may threaten the future of civilization as we know it, whether impacting land or ocean. Such events occur on average once per 100,000 years or less often. So we may have some time. What happens when an impact takes place? Bolides of up to 5 megatons, a great fireworks display, no damage. Tunguska class 15 megaton impact, damage similar to a large nuclear bomb, a city killer, average interval once every century. Just like Tunguska was, what, 1908, something like that? Minor risk relative to other natural disasters such as earthquakes and tsunamis. And then larger local or regional catastrophes with a 10,000 megaton force. Destroys an area equivalent to a small country, average interval once every 100,000 years. Global catastrophe in excess of 1 million megatons, global environmental damage threatening civilization, average interval for the whole Earth once every million years. Major risk relative to all other natural disasters. Kills more than 1.5 million people. We define this as globally catastrophic. Energy threshold calculated to be near 1 million megatons. Primary global effect is from stratospheric dust and smoke. Average interval 500,000 to 1 million years. Risk of order of magnitude greater than that of smaller impacts. Risk similar to other natural hazards such as earthquakes and severe storms. Unique capacity to destabilize civilization. Can be compared with global nuclear war. The only known natural hazard that can destroy civilization. This is part of the NASA authorization bill back in 1991, congressional statement. The House Committee on Science and Technology believes that it is imperative that the detection rate of Earth orbit crossing asteroids must be increased substantially, and that the means to destroy or alter the orbits of asteroids when they do threaten collisions should be defined and agreed upon internationally. The chances of the Earth being struck by a large asteroid are extremely small, but because the consequences of such a collision are extremely large, the committee believes it is only prudent to assess the nature of the threat and prepare to deal with it. As an attorney, I can tell you that risk is a function of 3 variables: the gravity of the risk should it occur, the frequency of the risk, and the cost of mediation. Those are the 3 factors that have to be considered, and this report more or less embraces that core concept of risk management. Our response to NEOs, what are we going to do about it if we find one? Well, the one in 2880, we'll put that off to a future Congress. We can't afford it now. Our approach to NEOs is interesting. Back in 2005, NASA launched the Deep Impact mission to be the, it was the first mission. We had some flybys like JATO back in the 90s, European Space Agency, went to Halley's Comet. But it was a flyby. Deep Impact mission actually not only flew by Comet 9P Temple, but launched a probe to impact it, to kick up debris that could be analyzed. Just like, you know, maybe hitting it with a rocket. Is that the best way to deal with it, by the way? Probably not. You know, many people think you're going to trade a slug for a shotgun blast. And, you know, that may or may not be the way to do it. Many people think gravitational tracking by putting a large satellite near, just knocking off that trajectory very slightly over enough time might be enough to alter its orbit for this particular pass that threatens us. Anyway, this rocket was launched on July 4th, 2005, intentionally. Does anybody know the significance of that date? If you get this, man, you're going to get a prize. It's much more subtle than that. This was the 50th anniversary of the first rock and roll single to make it number one on the record sales chart. Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and the Comets. There they are, singing their immortal classic. And in fact, NASA was so enraptured by this that they, after when the mission had succeeded, they called Bill Haley and the Comets to come to the Jet Propulsion Center in Pasadena, and they gave a concert. These guys were in their 80s now, a little slower, a little less, more forgetful, but they did. Everybody, there were 300 people that gathered around, gave them a standing ovation, and they actually petitioned the International Astronomical Union to name a comet after Bill Haley. That was done. So there you go. Here's the picture of that Deep Impact mission. And you see, here is the satellite itself. Here's the probe. And here's the comet that it was going to impact. It actually took pictures of the impact. You may remember this from 6 years ago. They were just absolutely extraordinary. Here's an artist's depiction of the probe. Here's an actual picture of it. Comet Temple 2005. We're not done yet. What could they be clapping in a beekeeper's meeting about? Oh, that's the other side here. Okay. Here it is. That is pretty good. I mean, you think about the velocity of this thing, a couple thousand miles an hour at least, and to put a probe near it, to launch a satellite, to launch a probe, to impact this thing. I mean, it's just absolutely an amazing feat of engineering to me. All done with Newtonian physics. 1687, Isaac Newton set about to explain the motion of everything in the universe, from a pea rolling on a plate to the motion of the planets. It was a fiendishly difficult task that he accomplished in three sentences. Here's kind of the exciting part of the evening. This is a new asteroid, question mark. About 2 months ago, I teach an astronomy class at Evangel University, just an intro class. This is the eighth year I've taught it. So I've got 35 or 40 students in the class. There were about 25 that came out to the house, and they always bring friends. So we had about 35 or so people in my driveway. Well, you got that many people. What are you going to do, line them up with the eyepiece? You each got two. Where is it? Where do I look? You do this for 35 or 40 people? Forget it. So what do? You hook it up to a camera, and you have a big screen there on a table next to the telescope where they can see what you want them to see. And that's exactly what I was doing. I had about a 24-inch flat panel screen hooked up to the CCD camera onto my, in this case, my 4-inch Takahashi FSQ-106ED-X3, new refractor, apochromatic refractor. That's an awesome instrument. I upgraded the Sky 90, the 90-millimeter tack, for this 106, so it's a 4-inch. And I hooked the STL 11000 CCD SBIG camera up to that telescope, and, you know, you just take a one-second image, and you see galaxy clusters. So I was taking 15-second images, and the students were gathered around. I said, you know, I think one of the things I love looking at more than anything else are galaxy clusters. So I was taking pictures in between Virgo and Canis Venatus, you know, the realm of the galaxies there, at the Virgo galaxy cluster. Thousands of galaxies in that relatively small area of the sky. And there they were, in 10 or 15 second images on the screen. Here we count 100 galaxies. I mean, it's just, I'll be honest with you, that is the most mind-boggling thing that I do when I'm imaging, those galaxy clusters. When you think about what you're looking at here, and I was trying to communicate that to these students, these little fuzzy ovals you see here, count them, there's dozens of them. Each one of these is a galaxy containing 100 billion or more suns. What vistas are there that we'll never see? What Grand Canyons? What Niagara Falls? You know, what Antarcticas? Is there life out there? All these imponderable questions that we think about. And so the students, I'm trying to not fill buckets, but light fires, Socrates' view of education. And so that's what I was trying to do. And they were kind of, some of them, as you know, you have strangers, or not strangers, but novices come out to look through your telescope, and the world can be divided into two groups. In my estimation, 90% will look at that, 100 galaxies, 60 million light years away, 60 million, the Virgo cluster. And they'll say, oh, that's nice, where's my video game? But 10% will look at that object and have a dim sense of what they're looking at, and it changes them forever. You know what I'm talking about? Yeah. And so that's what was happening this night. But here's what happened. I took one picture of the Virgo, just trying to center it so I could take a longer image of maybe a minute. This picture was 10 seconds. Okay? You see some galaxies up here. That's M87. And I noticed something that the students didn't. That line there. What is that? Well, it was too short to be a jet. I didn't think it was a man-made satellite. I thought it might be an asteroid. So I immediately assigned one of the students the task of telling me every minute with his iPhone. He put it on stopwatch, and I did a 10 or 15 second, I don't remember, maybe it's 10 second image, every minute. And here's what I saw. See that? What am I seeing here? The students were getting excited. I said, I did a quick search. My Sky 6 professional, what do they call it now, the Sky X, has a 500,000 asteroid database. I looked at this region, a very quick and dirty estimate. I couldn't see any asteroid in that field at this exact time. 9:57 p.m., whatever it was, and then accounting for Greenwich Mean Time. I couldn't see anything. I'm beginning to wonder, well, maybe it's a comet. My software shows about 365 comets. No comet in that area at that time, in that constellation. So I have a database of 5,000 man-made satellites. Nothing. I'm beginning to realize. The students say, what is it? I said, I think we're seeing here, class, potentially a yet undiscovered asteroid that, given its brightness, I mean, it seems to be of certainly large mass. This could be, and if it's intersecting the Earth's orbit, this could mean the end of civilization. Awesome. Yeah, quit using that word. Yeah, I mean, like, wow. You know how college students are. So, whoa, wow, awesome. So I said, listen, stop the non-lexical utterances. Now, let me explain what this could be, an Earth intersecting asteroid. And I was starting to get concerned about this. I had a sense that the whole weight of the human race was on my shoulders. I kind of tried to hurry the kids along, and by then it was 10:30 anyway. I said, you look like you're getting tired. So they left. I didn't have the time to get to this until Saturday. I can't believe it. I'm embarrassed to tell you that. But I'm the savior of humanity, and I'm putting it off 2 days. But that's right. I'm telling you the truth. I'm being honest. My wife said, be more of a people guy. So I'm telling you how it was. So on Saturday, my wife was gone. I was alone in the house, and I sat at my office at my computer, going through all this data and with much more rigor. 500,000 asteroids, 5,000 man-made satellites, 365 comets. I was, by process of elimination, ruling out in this very small quadrant At this exact time, nothing was there. I became convinced this was an undetected asteroid, possibly with an Earth intersecting orbit that could literally destroy human civilization. I had a sense of urgency. I went to the Minor Planet Center website. There it is. Let's watch this again. I kept watching this sequence, thinking, what am I seeing here? What have I been privileged of everybody on the Earth to see? You know, don't tell me astronomy is irrelevant. I mean, look at this. Look at the relevance of this. So what if you're a good baseball player? What difference does it make? How are you going to save humanity? So here's where I went, Dale. The International Astronomical Union Minor Planet Center, operated by Harvard Observatory. I went to Harvard Law School. I've been in this facility before. I said, this is where I have to report my finding. And somebody will get excited about this and look into it. And maybe they'll even name it after me. And some of the students asked me, are they going to name it after you, Dr. Hammer? I said, well, it all depends. If it's going to destroy civilization, I don't want it named after me. What was it that Adolf Hitler said when he defunded nuclear weapons research in 1942 because the Germans were winning by conventional weapons? We don't need to waste the money on atomic bombs. And he had this idea that if you started a chain reaction, an atomic bomb, there was no force on Earth that could stop it, and the whole Earth would go up in fire. And he made his famous statement, I don't want to be the person that goes down in history as the man who destroyed the world. I don't want to go down in history as the man who destroyed civilization. How would you like to have that comet name or that asteroid named after you? See what I'm going through? So all these thoughts are going to my mind. I'll worry about the name later. Let's just get this reported. And then something happened that was completely unexpected. I come to this site, and I go to here. How do I report my material? Doesn't that look like a good site? So that's where I went. I clicked on that, Jim, and I went there, and here's what I find. 44 instructions. The first one. You got to submit it in ASCII format. What is ASCII format for an email? I have to admit, I don't know what that means. I'm on Google. What is an ASCII format email? It took me an hour to figure that out. And then I moved on to number two. What is that? And I'm struggling with trying to figure this out. And after about 2.5 hours, I made it to number five, and only a couple of those that I did. So, I mean, class, this was one of the most intense experiences of my life. And I come out here, and here's all these things I had to do. And after five of these, I decided I can't do it. You are not allowed to speak to anybody in this place. You have to submit your finding using these 44 criteria, or it'll be rejected. And they said, we have filters, and if you miss one of these, it's going to be rejected. And we're not going to tell you if we reject it. Yeah, man, give me a break. This is horrible. I'm frustrated. I'm trying to save humanity, and I'm stopped by a bureaucracy. That was Saturday afternoon. Sunday comes. I'm wrestling with this. I'm walking around. People think I'm normal. But, I had that sense that the days are ticking by here. We may need those days to launch a mission. And I felt like the weight of civilization was on my shoulders, and I was letting days go by. I was going to be in big trouble. You knew this on Saturday, and you waited till Monday? So what happened was, look at these. It's ridiculous. And so here's what I'm seeing happening. And one person on Earth knows about it, and he can't communicate it. You see, I've set the stage for you. So I did the only thing I knew to do. On Monday morning, I called my friend, Greg Ojakangas. I said, Greg will help me. He's not going to turn me down. He was on the UFO panel last year. Oh, wasn't that good. So anyway, Greg said, listen, send me all the data you've got, the exact time. And that's what this site said, down to the tenth of a second. Give me a break. I don't know what the tenth of a second. Isn't the second close enough? No. And so, but I gave Greg what I had to the second. It was to the minute, actually. I told him the exact coordinates, the right ascension and declination of where the thing was. And that's what the site said. You have to give the right ascension and declination of the beginning and the ending of the object and time to the tenth of a second. I was throwing things at the computer by then. And so Greg said, I gave him all the data, and he said he was going to talk to a couple of NASA engineers that he knew, And they copied me on their email. There's all this email traffic going back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. They're thinking it's this, 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 this. And they finally came to the conclusion that it was a spent rocket booster from an Atlas V Centaur rocket that launched in 2004, launching a telecom satellite. And it's the empty canister of the lower stage that's just twirling in space. Greg wants to come over to my house and do some photometric measurements of that thing and try to determine its rate and angle of spin. And we may do that. You know, these things launch, and they put that rocket up in geosynchronous orbit, and the booster is just up there in orbit, and it takes a period of time for it to come down depending on a number of factors, but that's what it was. Here's the thing. I had the idea. I want to write a novel about this experience. Think about that. Attorney, erstwhile amateur astronomer, discovers Earth-destroying asteroid, but can't communicate it to the stupid Minor Planet Center. Wouldn't that be great? And they'd make a movie of it for sure. I want to star in the movie. I want to play myself. And, in fact, I'm a writer. I've written over 100 books, but they're all technical. They're tax and legal and risk management type books. So I want to read to you I've worked weeks on the first sentence of my novel. And I'd like to read it to you and see what you think. Okay?
Well, I want to know.
No questions. No, I want to get your honest opinion. I want your honest opinion as to whether this sentence is a good sentence. I've worked for weeks on this sentence for my novel. I'm not used to writing novels. See what you think about this, okay? And I'll read it to you. I'll give you a dramatic reading myself. I knelt down to study the baby squirrel I had found in my yard. And the squirrel was like, you know, hello, what are you looking at and stuff? And I was like, you know, can I like pick you up? And it goes like, burp, burp, burp. And I was like, you know, whoa, this is so wow.
I don't think you've got a shot there.
What's that?
I don't think you've got a shot. Better stay with the professor.
Now, guys, give me some encouragement here.
I think a visual.
I mean, didn't that have life to it? But that's my first. That's the best I could come up with in a couple intense weeks of writing. But I think that's a good segue into this amazing story. So we'll see. Yeah, we've talked about asteroids. Yeah. By the way, the largest known asteroid is Ceres, 630-mile diameter. It's big enough through hydrostatic equilibrium to form a sphere. Pallas, 377, the next biggest. And Vesta, 334-mile diameter. Hygieia, 279-mile diameter. Here's a picture I took of Ceres years ago. Man, back in the early days of astrophotography. But that's it right there. There's a picture of it drawn to scale compared to our moon and Earth. Here's an asteroid showing you one of the smaller ones, tens of miles in diameter. Insufficient mass for hydrostatic equilibrium to achieve spherical shape. And here's one of the few asteroids that has been discovered that actually has, it was the first one discovered with a moon. That's a 33-mile diameter asteroid. Isn't that amazing, that shot? Beringer Crater, anybody been there in Arizona? 160-foot asteroid is estimated, colliding at 30,000 miles per hour, produced a 4,000-foot crater, 600 feet deep, with an energy equivalent to 200 Hiroshima bombs. Anybody have your 3D glasses? Incidentally, this is a great image taken by one of the Mars rovers of a meteor in the skies of Mars. The Mars Global Surveyor that was up from 96 to 2006, 240,000 high-res images. And it's interesting that when those were studied pretty early on, they discovered impacts on the surface of Mars over the course of the lifespan of that satellite. So here we see a 1999 and a 2006 image of this very same field. You can look at these three large adjacent craters here and here with this one in the middle. And look at, this is the impact site, which is here in a picture taken 7 years later. There's a close-up of it. Many of these impacts have black holes, which are thought to be more or less like penetrating down through the crust to some extent. They're just voids. Okay, there it is in black and white. Okay, that's it. So any questions? Yes, ma'am. Konnichiwa. Oh, we speak Japanese.
I have read the entire Bible. I'm just studying one little page or something. But there's the Bible that I understand that you believe in God, right?
I do, yes. Well, I don't think so directly, but there are verses in Revelation and in Matthew that talk about the stars shall fall from the sky. That's a prophetic statement of Christ in the Olivet Discourse in Matthew, I think, in Matthew. And many Christians in the 19th century attributed that to one of the greatest meteor storms that ever occurred. A meteor storm is, you're looking at thousands and thousands of meteors in a minute. And that was seen by the entire western half of the United States. It spawned religions, sermons. I mean, it was incredible. And many people thought this was a perfect illustration of stars falling. That's one example. I don't necessarily think that you can point to any particular event like that. But there's no question that in some of the passages in the Gospels, when Jesus is talking about the end of the age, he uses language that refers to physical events in some of them in astronomy. But I am not an expert on that topic. We have one right here. We have a theology professor. You want to respond to that?
No.
Dr. Middlestep. Yes, earthquakes. What are some of those other ones? The moon would be like blood. It would be red.
Yeah.
And earthquakes,
certainly. Yeah. And those are all signs of?
Well, yeah, depending where they're recorded, but you'll see that stuff. Oh, you see some of that in Acts chapter 2, the fulfillment of the Joel passage. I guess the question that I would ask is whether you look at that stuff as being figurative or literal as to how it all unpacks. But certainly when it's written, that kind of picture is in the minds of writers. So they've got some kind of astronomical sense for them to be able to describe such events.
Mm-hmm.
I need an astronomer to figure that out.
Yeah, and the thing is, these events that are described are recurring. You have lots of earthquakes. You have lots of meteor showers. So to say this is the one that has prophetic significance to me is very difficult. Look at the guy that just predicted the earth was coming to an end.
There's that scale.
Torino scale?
Yeah. The number, the highest one.
10?
The most impactful.
Yeah.
Wipeout civilization. Is it said every 100,000 years?
Or less.
Well,
you think back to when the last one was that would be civilization destroying. We don't know when it happened. It hasn't happened since the dawn of man. There's a lot that have happened that we don't know about. Yeah, and I don't know that there's physical evidence of it. You know, there's a professor at Missouri State, a geology professor, I don't know if he's spoken here or not before. I don't remember his name. But he's actually postulates that a meteor chain, you know, if you look at the surface of some of the Saturn and Saturn's moons in particular, you see these chains of craters. Have you seen those? It's like a line of crater, just they're almost adjacent. And astronomers weren't exactly sure what caused those crater chains until Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 in 1994, when that massive comet entered Jupiter's Roche limit and immediately breaks up into nine huge chunks, and who knows how many smaller ones, and caused those impacts in a line right on the surface. And, man, that's... So this professor has come up with a theory. I haven't talked to him for a number of years about this, but that actually there's evidence of a crater chain between Springfield and Kansas City that he's been able to detect using satellite photos. You can't see it walking on the ground. You have to have elevation to actually see, like, remnants of craters, which is a fascinating concept. So that would have happened here. Who knows? Maybe you could use erosion timing to come up with some estimate of when that occurred. I didn't ask him about if there was, like, a time estimate of when that happened. But interesting thought. Okay, that's it.